is not going to notice by me, however, that I am the Halloween chapel speaker. Thank you. I don't know what to make of that, really. Someone actually asked me this morning whether I was in costume. Doc, I think that's a shot at the bow tie, is what that is. And I must tell you that my bow tie wear, I don't wear a bow tie all the time, but it is in tribute to Dr. Edward McKinley. We all, of course, try to be like Dr. Edward McKinley. I'm not as tall as he is. I'm not as smart as he is, as evidenced by several grades you gave me in your class. Not that I'm bitter. But let's hope you don't get in trouble for vote buying. It's a privilege for me to be here with my colleagues on the Board of Trustees. It's a real honor to serve with them. As I say, I love coming back to campus. One of my favorite spots is that bank of windows in the library. I spent a little bit of time there yesterday looking out on campus. And this time of year in particular, it's just stunning. But I got to tell you something. It's not the best view on campus. The best view on Asbury's campus is the one I have right now. We take this hour seriously in the life of this college, and those of us asked to share it with you consider it a high honor. Well, to Americans of a certain generation, evenings that were lit by the dim glow of an oil lamp are a memory derived from personal experience. These are your grandparents and your great-grandparents that came of age in a nation in which 90% of rural America did not have electricity. I was just with my 87-year-old grandmother, and we were recounting a story that my mother loved to tell. And it was of coming home from school and her parents reaching up above the kitchen table and turning on the light for the first time. Now consider this. Since 1970, the amount of artificial light worldwide has tripled. Virtually no American, unless they choose, need live in darkness, a triumph of government and technology, but with a startling result. According to a study published by the Royal Astronomical Society, about two-thirds of the world's population, including almost everyone living in Europe and almost everyone living in the continental United States, no longer sees a sky full of stars because the night is too bright. This breathtaking march of technology and all of its remarkable benefits stealing from us and our children one of creation's most awe-inspiring natural wonders, the poetry of heaven, to quote Lord Byron. I'm wondering this morning what it means for us to live and serve authentically in that world, in the world in which human progress presents an almost limitless possibility for good, while at the same time obscuring our view of that which grants us perspective. The world in which we often conquer, both figuratively and literally, darkness, but one where we can't even see the stars. Now, most of you are members of what has been coined the Millennium Generation, or Generation Y. I don't know how helpful these characterizations are, but you know the description. You're peer-oriented, you're overachieving, you're overscheduled, you've been raised by these so-called helicopter parents who are hovering over you, trying to help you succeed. You're brand conscious. You put a premium on workplace culture as you think about going off into the workplace. And of course, you're tech savvy. You are very tech savvy. Every one of you virtually owns a computer. 97% of you have downloaded music or other media using peer-to-peer file sharing. I trust legally. I have ways of finding out who you are, just so you know. Almost all of you own a cell phone. 8 out of 10 use instant messaging or social networking sites. 4 out of 10 either author a blog or you access a blog on a regular basis. And this statistic I find fascinating. For over a third of you, your primary source of news is not a newspaper, it's not television, it's the internet. You are a generation that has grown up with and understands the great promise of technological developments in this age in which we live, but it is also an age of great peril. Technology can be a source of both hope, but also fear. You and I have part of our lexicon the words international terrorism and weapons of mass destruction. In 2001, on 9/11, I passed by the Pentagon moments after it was struck by a passenger aircraft. I was driving in the shadow of great clouds of black smoke. And then minutes later, I found myself running with thousands of others from the congressional offices on Capitol Hill on reports of another attack. I know what it feels like to be a target. And yet, in some ways, the most unsettling events were not those of that day, but of those that began less than 10 days later. We don't know for sure who sent the anthrax contained in several letters sent to the offices of 2 U.S. senators, all 3 major television networks, and 2 national newspapers, but we do know the tragic result. 5 deaths and many seriously injured. The cost to the perpetrator, the prime suspect, by the way, sadly took his own life this summer shortly before being indicted. The cost was less than $3,000. The cost of the response to that act of terrorism, that act in which we've already experienced the use of weapons of mass destruction, was hundreds of millions of dollars. And it's that asymmetry that produces the greatest cost of that act. And that's fear. Now, it's true, as Philip Bobbitt of Columbia Law School writes, that the total number of persons worldwide who have been killed by a terrorist is about the same number as those who drowned in bathtubs in the United States. But consider this. Using an aircraft dispensing a relatively small amount of anthrax spores, around 1,000 kilograms, on a calm and clear night, over a distance of just a few hundred square miles could very well result in 1 to 3 million dead. Killed because of scientific advancements applied to the ancient bacteria that some believe to be the sixth plague in the book of Exodus. Now, I'm not trying to suggest that this state of affairs that we found ourselves in this unsettling time is somehow unprecedented. I, and perhaps most of your parents and the faculty, the administrators, were educated in the midst of the Cold War in the specter of nuclear destruction. But I can't help but feel that we face in the world today a host of problems of a different order of magnitude entirely. Now, the sense that I have may not be one that you share at this particular point in your life. It's not that Asbury is really a place that's uniquely set apart from the cares of the world. I've never really believed that. It's that the academy generally is set apart from those cares. You will be tempted when you leave this place to continue that splendid isolation. To a degree, you might even be able to succeed with the choice of the right circle of friends, the right private school, the right church, complete with self-contained recreation and entertainment options. But don't be fooled that you can choose that course without consequence. Asbury demands that you engage the culture and the world not merely out of a sense of benevolence, but out of a self-interest organized around a worldview that values liberty and values individual autonomy. You need to be a citizen in the classic meaning of that word to ensure that you and the generations yet to come are able to love, prosper, and worship in peace and freedom. How is it then that we prepare you at Asbury College for that call in this world? How do we provision you for a journey full of great joy and triumph, but also risk and anguish? It's in this way. We seek to instill in you indelibly a profound understanding of the human condition and consequently an understanding of what matters. St. Augustine wrote that men go abroad to wonder at the heights of the mountains, at the huge waves of the sea, at the long course of the rivers, at the compass of the ocean, at the circular motions of the stars, and they pass themselves without wondering. Augustine's caution is about neglect. It's about living the unexamined life, the path of least resistance in a complicated and busy world. It's not hard to understand why this might be the case. After all, our own Paul Vincent has reminded us that there is something wrong with us. And we live in a postmodern world that denies that we are less than capable of doing all things. But it is true. There is something wrong with us. And we accept it as fundamental to our worldview. But how are you going to respond to that condition? I read a lot of biographies in my line of work. They're called pre-sentence investigation reports. And they describe broken lives and the resulting violence connected to those lives, violence that we feel in this community in the eastern half of Kentucky. It's hard not to feel sometimes a sense of futility in terms of the prospect of the human condition. Joseph Conrad said rather depressingly that the entire history of humanity could be summarized as follows. They were born, they suffered, they died. Lawyers engage in both the potential and the failure of the human condition. We're called upon to enforce the laws, to referee the conflicts, and to advocate on behalf of the just and the unjust. And there is no greater occupational hazard for the lawyer than cynicism. Cynicism born out of the fundamental truth that in the end, standing alone, we fail. There's a word, of course, for denying that this is the case. And that word is pride. C.S. Lewis famously calls that the great sin. And it's not saying too much when he concludes that it is this conceit that eats up the very possibility of love or contentment or even common sense. The world needs men and women who, understanding the flawed nature of humanity, will forcefully engage our culture with a measure of humility. It's not an easy task in a society that too often rewards hubris and arrogance. I operate in a professional world in which people stand when I walk into the room, and I always get the last word. That is in dramatic contrast to the way it works at my home. Let me tell you, it's not a healthy environment professionally. And you're going to find efforts to play to your ego all around. I thought it was ironic. I was working on these remarks earlier this week, and I got an email. My little chime chimed, and I got an email from the Ritz-Carlton hotel chain. I just wanted to share it with you. It says right here, it says, "Yes, you are the center of the universe." How great is that? It is encouraging me. It says, "It's our pleasure, by the way, to tell you that." And then it's encouraging me to reserve a room on the Ritz-Carlton club level and experience a hotel within a hotel that redefines what it means to enjoy personalized service. That's all about me. How great is that? They offer continuous culinary offerings throughout the day. This is a little bit like being a member of the Board of Trustees. They feed you really, really well when you're here. If I haven't eaten for 2 hours, I think something's wrong. A dedicated concierge that attends to your individual needs and a heightened sense of exclusivity. That's what we really need. Our club experience will cater to your every whim. That's the culture that you're going to be entering into. Now, there are external antidotes for this, as I've said. My children are one that I'd like to name and claim this morning. But, you know, that is never enough. I need, and so will you, the self-imposed equivalent of the Roman slave assigned the task of riding in the chariot and reminding the emperor of his mortality with a whisper in the ear. The longer I live, the more I believe that what is needed in law and politics and business and in our schools, our churches, our homes, is men and women who, with confidence and a sense of purpose, will choose grace. sensitivity, mercy, generosity of spirit, what Peggy Noonan defines as a courtesy so deep it amounts to beauty. This is easier to envision now than when you are fully engaged beyond the academy. Then, the cynics you encounter may very well dismiss these words with derision, not because they're untrue, but because they arise more from the heart than the head. Part of what this institution does is grant you a place, a sense of place in history with a set of values that you can return to as your life accelerates. The world is desperate for those who will engage the problems of poverty and war and violence and disease in the public arena or the private mission with both heart and head. But when you do, you will be faced with a lie. And it's this: that the world values fame, power, and money. In the end, it doesn't. Navigating those waters is not easy. In the midst of it, you will need a strong sense of from where you started and why. I'm from Wilmore. I grew up here. I return with some frequency, and I was reminded recently of the path that I took on the way to kindergarten. We were living in student housing that the seminary has now, despite the historical significance of it, torn down. It was not a particularly long path, but took me across a busy road through the Wilmore Cemetery, the cemetery where my mother is now buried, across a factory parking lot, around the old trailer park to the basement of the Wilmore United Methodist Church. I'm going to spare you the details of the great adventures occasioned by those journeys, but I'll tell you that today I'm a product of them in a way more influential than what might seem to be far more significant events that came after. You see, those things that shape us and define us should sustain us. We all need a sense of place, a deep understanding of where we come from and what is important, because we operate in a culture that is increasingly relative. It's a world in which the answer to so many of life's questions is offered up as "it depends." And so your memory, what the Southern author Reynolds Price calls those clear pictures, can provide a reference to things that matter and are true no matter what. Just a kid from Wilmore becomes not a self-deprecating reference, but a reminder of what lasts. And it's a way of keeping your word to the 5-year-old you once were. If you let her, Asbury College is going to give you a touchstone. We're founded on old ideas drawn from a Western tradition that understands our fallen nature and the transcendent power of reason and faith in a creator that exists above and outside and over this troubled world. We believe that the starting point for making sense of a world filled with evil begins with recognizing that our lives are defined not by a struggle to do what is wrong, but what is right. I must admit this morning that I'm at that age of reassessment that accompanies midlife. Dante called it a dark wood. In honesty, requires me to plead to a certain restlessness and regret that comes with approaching 50. I feel acutely, perhaps more than in any time in the past, the times that I've failed as a father and as a husband and also as a son. I've not always been the friend that I've wanted to be. I've talked too much. I've listened too little. Sometimes I've not worked hard enough when it was required, and too hard as a poor substitute for more worthy things. And too often I've been a critic when what was really needed was simply to care. You know, as do I, that people will always disappoint you. Because in the end, we disappoint ourselves. And there's no greater antidote to the cynicism that lurks when that happens than believing in and being transformed by the promise we have as Christians. This summer, I found in a surprising place a description that powerfully captures our hope. In his novel, The Kite Runner, Khaled Hosseini crafts a rich story about friendship and family, about loyalty and betrayal, about sacrifice and redemption. Many of you have probably read the novel. Taking place from the final days of Afghanistan's monarchy to the brutal rule of the Taliban, it arises from a religious and cultural context that is very different than our own. And yet there's much in this work that is true. Amir, the central character, has his life immeasurably changed at the age of 12 by a singular act of cowardice. A moment in which there was no will to do the right thing. Years later, as an adult, Amir hears these words from the book's wisest voice. There is a way to be good again. There it is. This profound truth that transcends the story and declares the promise that is so central to our faith. To the early church, Paul put it this way: if anyone is in Christ, he's a new creation. Old things have passed away. Behold, all things have become new. So, when you choose self over the care of your neighbor, there's a way to be good again. When you feed your addictions at the expense of reality, there is a way to be good again. When you allow fear and insecurity to deaden your soul, there is a way to be good again. And when you let the great sin of pride subdue your better instincts and break the hearts of those you love, there is a way to be good again. Here, at this place, if we do nothing else, it's to show you that way and pray that you will take it. It's Bunyan's path. It's full of danger and distraction. We can't lead you by the hand in that direction. And it's a journey that while you must choose, you can't complete it on your own. But it is the way. It is the way in a world in which you can't even see the stars. Go. Choose that way. Find the place that in the songwriter's words is around the ceiling of the heart, where even the blind can see the stars. Go into the darkness and look to the sky and know and believe that though obscured, the stars are indeed still there. Go with the words of Galileo ringing in your ears that I have loved the stars too fondly to be fearful of the night. Go. Go. Go.